Okay, this is Margaret Plattner, Deputy Commissioner with the Kentucky Department of Veterans Affairs, and today's date is August the 24th, 2009, and I'm here interviewing Donna Scrivener. Donna, why don't you state your name, your branch of service, length of service, and your area of specialty?
My name is Donna Nelson Scrivener. My maiden name was Nelson. I served in the United States Navy for 18 years. I retired early under the Temporary Early Retirement Act. I was a surface warfare officer for my first 12 years, and then I spent the remainder of my career as an engineering duty officer after having gone to the Naval Postgraduate School.
Tell me about your background, something about your background prior to joining the military.
I was raised in a Navy family. My father was a naval officer when I was born. He was 27 years in the Navy, 23 years at sea. He enlisted in World War II, fought in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. My most vivid memories are of my father in Vietnam. That's when I was young. He retired just before I went to high school. So I was raised, you know, in a Navy background. My father never pressured me to join the military. He never even discussed it. But I was raised with a strong sense of service, that at some point I needed to pay back for being an American citizen. There was just some, I would have to do something in my life to say thank you. And I chose to join the military. Of four siblings, I was the only one who did. I was in college, majoring in anthropology and psychology. I had no interest in going to ROTC. I had been offered an appointment to the Naval Academy and had turned it down. I would have been the second class with women, and I didn't care to participate in that particular experiment at that particular time. Mm-hmm. So I thought about it, but went to college, you know, uncommitted. In my junior year, I spoke to a recruiter, and I signed up, and I joined. After I graduated from college, I went home for a couple months and then went to officer candidate school.
In Newport?
Newport, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you do your undergrad?
I went to the State University of New York at Cortland.
Okay. Is that home? Is New York home?
As close to home as a Navy brat has.
Got it.
When my dad retired from the Navy, we moved to upstate New York.
Okay.
And that's pretty much where we stayed.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I went home one day from college and said, oh, by the way, I joined the Navy. And I had no idea how much it would mean to my father for me to do that, because he had never mentioned it. But he was thrilled. He just wanted to make very sure that it was my decision and that I didn't feel pressured to do it. And I was touched that it meant so much to him to have me join. So we went.
So you joined the military as a sense of duty and service.
Mm-hmm.
And did you choose the Navy because of your father?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That was what I knew. That was what I was comfortable with, you know. And I just sort of loved Navy culture, and it never occurred to me to join a different branch of service.
Okay, and tell me now. You served 18 years, so I'm curious to know, from the day you were commissioned.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me each tour of duty,
okay,
where you served, and in what capacity. And then we'll take it from there.
Okay. I went to officer candidate school intending to be...
What year did you go?
I went in 1981,
okay,
right after college.
Okay.
I was actually commissioned in 1982, just at the start of the year. And I went intending to become a protocol officer. I had no intention of becoming a warfare officer. Didn't even know that I could. I thought I would get a degree in protocol. I would use it towards my master's degree in anthropology. You know, I was just going to do one tour and then get out. But when I was at officer candidate school, we became aware that there were 5 officer candidate slots a year available for women to go to sea. 17 a year. 1977 was the first year that they opened the Women at Sea program. It was only for officers. It was 17 billets a year, 7 for the Naval Academy, 5 for ROTC, 5 for OCS. And that meant just about every OCS class should have one billet. But because we chose billets based on class standing, the only way you were going to be guaranteed to get the ship billet was if you were number one. As soon as I knew that only one person could have it, I wanted to have it. And so I became very competitive. It turned out that there were 2 for my class. And we were, while I wasn't number one, I was the second highest woman who wanted a ship. There were a few women ahead of me. I think I was the fifth woman. There was one other woman who wanted a ship. Her name was Donna Looney, and she had been an enlisted signalman, and she'd been commissioned. She wanted to go back to sea, and she was 1/100th of a grade point ahead of me. And so she had first pick, and she picked a ship on the East Coast, and there was a second ship billet, and it was on the West Coast, and I picked that one.
Now, how'd you get a second ship billet when there was only one billet per class?
Luck of the draw.
Okay.
It was just a fluke.
Okay.
There just happened to be a second ship available.
Okay.
So I took it.
What ship?
It was the USS Proteus.
Okay.
AS-19. It was a submarine tender homeported in Guam.
Okay.
Theoretically, I should have gone to Surface Warfare Officer School in Coronado, but because I was a woman and because Donna was going to be going through Surface Warfare Officer School in Newport, they decided to keep me with her so that we would go through together. I actually would have rather gone to San Diego, but nobody asked me. So we went through Surface Warfare Officer School together.
And how long was that?
That was, at the time, I think it was 17 weeks.
Okay.
And it was a really good introduction to all things having to do with ships, from administrative to ship handling, everything. It was a wonderful course. Of course, she and I were the only women that were there. Not particularly warmly received by our classmates. It was about 50-50 with the staff.
Were you teased, or were you just, was it subtle?
There was nothing subtle about it.
Okay.
No, we were teased, we were pushed, we were shoved, we were cursed. It was pretty rough, but we were young and committed. And the professors, the instructors, they weren't professors, they were officers. They ranged from neutral, which meant they probably didn't like it but weren't going to say anything, to incredibly supportive. And I think there were enough supportive instructors that, we really felt like we were going to do well. And the fact that Donna and I were at the top of the class, pretty much, locked in our position, so... I don't have many bad memories of it. I do remember that at the time women were not allowed on combatant ships at all. We could go out for the day, but we weren't allowed to spend the night. And there was a ship, it was the USS Cone, that was going out to do the test firing of a rocket. An anti-submarine rocket, and they invited us aboard. It was about five.
Is this during your training?
It was when we were officer candidate school. And there were about five guys and Donna and I that were invited aboard. And we went out, and we were very enthusiastic and, asking questions. We were all over the place. And the captain took a liking to us. And when it was just about time for us to turn around and come back in, he decided that it didn't look good. And he really didn't think that we should return to port and that it would be more prudent to continue on to the site where they were going to do the next day's testing. So he sent a message in asking for permission to keep us on board for safety reasons.
You and Donna. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so, which meant that the boys had to stay too. The mm-hmm. guys had to stay too.
Mm-hmm.
So they got permission to keep us, which was a total ruse. There was no reason the captain couldn't return to port. But that was the only way he was going to be allowed to let us have this experience. So we were excited, and we didn't mind that we didn't have a toothbrush, we didn't have any clothes, we didn't have anything. The men were grumbling. They were not happy. But we were just thrilled to have the opportunity. So we got to go out and spend another full day at sea doing man overboard drills and, firing weapons. And I mean, it was so exciting for us. And to this day, I'll never forget how wonderful that captain was to make that opportunity available to us.
So you graduated.
So we graduated from Surface Warfare School.
Toward the top of your class,
mm-hmm.
is that right?
Yes.
You and Donna both did.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
we both
did. So you go off to your next assignment.
My first ship. I they didn't know what to do with me. At the time, I think there were five women total on board the ship, but one was a lawyer, one was a supply officer, and then there were two other division officers. But they wanted to put me in the repair department, and there had never been a woman in the repair department. So they sent me down to the repair department head, and he didn't know where to put me. He didn't want me, didn't want a woman. He decided I could be his administrative officer. And I remember when I walked into his office, he had been an enlisted warrant officer before he'd been commissioned, so he'd been around a long time. And he was sitting at his desk, and he sat there, and he looked at me, and he just glared at me. And then he put his arms across the desk and pulled himself over the desk till he was right in my face. And he said, "You look soft. I'm going to have to toughen you up. And you better believe it's going to be a long, bloody process." I just sat there and said, "Yes, sir." And he made me his admin officer. And that lasted for about a month and a half till he realized that I was completely overqualified. I started sneaking out and learning things behind his back. And he decided in pretty short order to give me a repair division. So he made me the repair division officer and gave me a bunch of other miscellaneous divisions to do. And I worked for him for probably my first year and a half.
And how did that go overall with him?
It was wonderful.
Really?
He became my biggest fan.
Oh, isn't that awesome?
He was absolutely amazing. Yeah, he was easy to win over. As soon as you proved that you could do the job and that you were a hard worker, that's all he asked.
Mm-hmm.
So he was wonderful. Okay. And then after that, they sent me to the engineering department. I was the electrical officer for about a year. And then they sent me to the auxiliaries division, and I was the auxiliaries officer for a year.
And how were those experiences?
They were a lot of fun. It was very exciting. Engineering was hard. My ship was a World War II era ship. It had been built during World War II. It had served in World War II. It was one of the three oldest ships in the Navy at the time. So it was falling apart. And they used to joke that the tenders, which was the repair ship, were called tenders, that they were welded to the pier, and that women who got sent to repair ships never deployed. That wasn't true of the Proteus in Guam. It had been for some time, but for about the last few years prior to me getting there and while I was there, we actually deployed half the time. We would be 6 months in Guam and then 6 months on cruise. We'd go to the Philippines, we'd go to Hong Kong, we'd go back to Guam. So we actually got a lot of sea time, which was very exciting. It was supposed to be an 18-month tour, and then I was supposed to be rotated ashore to do 18 months on a stateside ship. I got extended on board so many times that by the time I left...
At the captain's request.
Yeah, I did 42 months of an 18-month tour.
Wow.
On the Proteus.
Wow.
So.
Obviously, you were highly valued.
Yes.
Tell me about the sleeping arrangements. How did that work on the ship?
We had...
At that time.
We did not have enlisted women. We only had women officers.
Okay.
So we had staterooms.
Okay.
And they were basically 2, 4, or 6-man staterooms. And so usually the women I had my own stateroom for a long time because I was the last woman on board. So we just basically would share staterooms. We didn't have a women's head bathroom.
Okay.
We had a sign.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were supposed
mm-hmm.
to flip the sign
mm-hmm.
when you went in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's...
So that arrangement worked fairly well?
Mm-hmm. Good. We all got along. On a tender, I would say almost all of the officers are prior enlisted. They tend to be warrant officers and limited duty officers. The only line officers were women. You would never get... If a male line officer was sent to a tender... It's because he was on his way out of the Navy. It was absolutely the worst possible billet for a man, the best possible job for a woman.
Interesting. Very interesting.
But the supply officers, you had supply officers and dental officers, medical officers. So we had a huge wardroom. There were, I think, 1,700 people on the ship.
So being a repair ship, you had a non-combatant role.
Absolutely.
Okay.
My entire tour in the surface warfare specialty, women were not allowed on combatants.
Okay.
That didn't change until after I switched.
Okay. So you're 42 months on
mm-hmm.
this tender. Then what was your, after that, where did you go?
I went to San Diego to be an
okay.
instructor at the Surface Warfare Officer School
okay.
in Coronado.
Okay. So you finally got there in some way, shape, or form.
I got there. And I was a shipboard management instructor, of course, because that's a girl's job. So I taught shipboard management, but I also taught in the simulators. So, you know, teaching ship driving and things like that
mm-hmm.
to the young ensigns. Very few women came through while I was there.
Okay.
At that time, we were still limited
to...
Was
it the mid-80s?
I was 82 to 85
okay.
on Proteus, so it was
right.
85 to 87
okay.
Was when I was at Coronado.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of fun, but it was mostly male officers. And, you know, you had to overcome that... Why is there a girl standing in front of me teaching me?
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't take long
mm-hmm.
to win them over.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was there about till 87.
And then where did you go after that?
Then they decided finally that we could be department heads. When I became a division officer, that was the end. Women were not going to be department heads. We were only going to be division officers. And there was some hope that at some point they would let us be department heads. So while I was at Surface Warfare Officer School teaching, I was negotiating for orders. And they changed their mind and they said that women could be department heads. So they started sending us through department head school. And I got orders to be a chief engineer, which was unheard of for a woman. I think that I was maybe 10th, 11th, or 12th female chief engineer in the Navy.
Oh, that's awesome.
There were not many of us out there. But they sent us back east. Department head school was in Newport. Everybody went there. And that was a long course. I want to say 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I may not be accurate, but
primarily did that training entail?
Mostly combat training. It was to be certified as a tactical action officer. So a good half of what we did was tactical action officer training, which was incredibly frustrating for me because I was memorizing Soviet radars and weapons profiles, and I knew that I was never, ever going to be in a position to utilize that information. So that was very frustrating. I was the highest.
Yes, because you were a woman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. There was no ship that we could take.
Okay.
I got the highest score in the anti-submarine warfare curriculum, but
That's awesome.
But
awesome.
It was brutal. I mean, intellectually, it was brutal. I was a newlywed. I had gotten married while I was teaching at Surface Warfare Officer School.
Did you marry a Navy person?
I did.
Okay.
When I was on Proteus, we had deployed to the Indian Ocean. And we were in Diego Garcia. My husband's to-be husband submarine had pulled up alongside,
mm-hmm.
and we had met,
mm-hmm.
Hung out a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and then he left and I left, and we corresponded for about a year and a half, and then we both finagled orders to San Diego. So he was actually teaching at the sonar schools when I was teaching at Surface Warfare School, and we dated for year and a half. We were engaged for a year. We got married, and then we got sent to department head school. And he was submariner, so he went to submarine
okay.
department head school,
okay.
and I went to Newport for surface department head school. And that was probably the most horrible time in my career. That's when I think I came up across the most violent opposition to me being in the Navy and me being a department head.
From whom?
From my fellow students.
Were you the only woman here in the department?
I think there was one other woman there.
Okay.
She wasn't in many of my classes.
So what kind of feedback were you getting?
Oh, I would be pushed, shoved, hit.
Just walking or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You'd have somebody, give you a good shove in the hallway or trip you as you're going down the stairs. Definitely teasing in the classroom. Anytime, they would mention a ship's response to a stressful situation, there would be of course, if you're an attender, you can throw potatoes at them or, something like that. It was definitely where they would demean our role, in the fleet.
How did you handle that?
I ignored it.
Okay.
Toughed it out, would just make snide comments. But, it was tough, I don't think I ever questioned my resolve, but it was uncomfortable, definitely not pleasant.
Did you get support from your husband?
Mm-hmm. He was pretty good, but he was also deep in his own,
mm-hmm.
I tried not to bring too much of it home because
mm-hmm.
he was going through his own stressful mm-hmm. curriculum
mm-hmm.
at the time.
So you finished department head school.
I was sent to Great Lakes for a little bit of advanced training in firefighting and boiler water, feed water, engineering stuff.
Where's your husband at this point?
He was going to some follow-on schools himself. We were supposed to be stationed together in San Diego, but his ship actually was in overhaul in San Francisco. So he got sent up to San Francisco, and I got sent to San Diego, although we were technically, this was our co-located tour. So we just didn't see much of each other, which is probably a good thing, because as a chief engineer, you don't see anybody. You don't have time. So he was out of sight, out of mind, and I was really focused on my tour. I did a little over 2 years as chief engineer. Chief engineer is the hardest job in the Navy.
And you served on?
It was the USS Jason, which was a heavy repair ship,
okay.
another tender,
okay.
non-combatant.
Okay.
We had, at that time, we had enlisted women. We had probably 200 enlisted women.
Wow. How many people overall served on the ship?
About 1,800.
Wow. Okay.
Not many women. Okay. Scattered throughout the ship. I probably had
How did
about...
that work with the women and the men working together?
That was my first introduction to the problem of fraternization. You know, because there was an awful lot of fraternization going on. And I think...
Between officer and enlisted?
Both officer and enlisted, and just between male and female enlisted personnel. A lot of unplanned pregnancies, a lot of catching people where they shouldn't be. I think most of that was due to just the youth of the women, because it wasn't usually the woman's idea. I found that they were often taken advantage of by, older, more senior enlisted folks on the ship, some naive girls making bad decisions. But I tried to set up a culture in my department where I held my senior enlisted folks responsible for educating everybody, the men and the women, about, appropriate behavior, and that I expected them to sit down and talk to the enlisted women about birth control and bad choices and that sort of thing. They thought they were going to be able to just send all the girls to me, and that I would talk to them. And I explained that that wasn't the department head's job, and they needed to do it. And they got pretty good at it, but I was the first female chief engineer that anyone on my ship had ever worked for. In fact,
so you were the first female engineer
on that ship.
On that ship,
absolutely.
Okay.
And
what was that experience like?
It was professionally very challenging. Personally, it was a breeze because I was a department head, which meant, people tend to defer to department heads. I wasn't going to have, trouble from the junior officers because I was a department head,
Now, at this point, are you a full lieutenant?
I was a full lieutenant.
Okay.
Actually, a fairly senior lieutenant.
Okay.
And I was the junior department head, but, I had, it was six junior officers working for me, mm-hmm. ensigns and lieutenants, mm-hmm. junior grade, mm-hmm. Mostly men, although occasionally a woman would cycle through.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting.
That go?
Pretty well,
Good.
Pretty well. I had more trouble with my male officers who had chosen to marry young and were struggling with balancing their home life and their work life, and they gave me a lot more trouble than the women officers that worked for me, because they tended to be very focused and very committed. There was never an issue of priorities. So it was a good time. I mean, I enjoyed mentoring the junior officers on board. Got to be very close friends with the other women that were on board. We had a nice array of, lawyers, doctors, dentists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
Definitely a lot of very, very strong women. But it was, it's a challenging tour, especially on an old ship. Again, it was a World War II era ship, one of the oldest in the Navy at the
mm-hmm.
time. And when I was in the Navy, the survival rate for chief engineers was 2 out of 3 made it. So 33% failed to complete their first engineer tour. They either...
Why is that?
It was a mixture of mental breakdown and being relieved for cause.
That's so stressful?
Mm-hmm.
Is that stressful?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And
what makes the job so stressful?
You're basically responsible for everything. Everything, responsible for everything has to do with propulsion, with lighting, systems. You've got safety issues, people, training issues. Anything that goes wrong is the department head's fault.
Okay.
And if the ship can't meet its commitments because the ship can't get underway, that's a problem. There are a lot of safety programs that you have to be responsible for. Hearing safety, heat conservation. I mean, it's just everything. And the slightest administrative flaw can lead to being relieved for cause.
Okay, so once you finish that assignment, then where are you?
At that point,
next?
I was approached about whether or not I wanted to be an executive officer, and then which would have been the next step to command at sea. I made the decision that I wanted a family. I decided I wanted to have children, and I did not want to risk having to deploy just after the birth of a child. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I started submitting applications to transfer to the Engineering Duty Officer Corps. It was very unlikely.
Why engineering duty?
Because they don't deploy.
Okay.
Engineering duty officers do not deploy.
What do they do?
I wanted to build ships.
Mm-hmm.
That was my passion was new construction. I wanted to go to a shipyard and build a ship. So the engineering duty officer program is designed to take officers with an engineering background, give them a specialized master's degree, and then put them into positions where they can be responsible for key construction projects. And that was the only thing I knew about engineering duty officer. They also did a lot of repair facility work. So I went to the readiness support group, which coordinated maintenance for all the ships on the San Diego waterfront. I was given all of the non-combatants, of course. The cruisers and destroyers were handled by my male counterpart. They gave me all of the support ships, all of the ammunition ships and the tenders and mm-hmm. Actually, they gave me all of the amphibious ships as well. When they're technically combatant, but they're not as sexy as cruisers and destroyers. So I got all those. And I had to organize all their maintenance and schedule all of it, which was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed that. And it was during this tour that I was accepted as an engineering duty officer candidate, which meant that I would be sent to the Naval Postgraduate School to get my engineering master's degree.
In Monterey, California.
In Monterey, California. The only problem was my undergraduate degree was in psychology and anthropology, and I wanted to get a master's degree in mechanical engineering. So they sent my husband and I both to Monterey to get master's degrees. He was supposed to be getting electrical engineering, and I was supposed to be getting mechanical. They switched him to mechanical so he could help me with it, because he had an undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering from the Naval Academy, and they thought it would be supportive if he did that. I spent about a year and a half.
Did you need that?
It didn't help. I spent a year and a half struggling with the curriculum and couldn't get it. I didn't fail anything, but I wasn't doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the fact that I went to Monterey with a 13-month-old child and 6 months pregnant with my second one, it was not a good time to try to do something that academically challenging. So after about a little over a year, they took me aside and said, this is not going to work. And they offered me computer science. I didn't know anything about computer science. I didn't even know how to turn on a computer. My ships were World War II vintage. We didn't have computers. So I'd had no experience with it. But I said, what the heck? You know, I didn't want to get kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
So I switched over to the computer science curriculum. And they were very helpful. And for the next two and a half years, I worked on my my master's degree in computer science. I got it with an emphasis.
Did you enjoy it?
It was fun.
Okay.
It was good. I mostly enjoyed having time with my kids. Mm-hmm. It was a much less stressful
mm-hmm.
environment
mm-hmm.
than being at sea.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot of fun. Monterey was beautiful. We had a good time. So it was definitely more like the mom time that I enjoyed. And like I said, the academics weren't that stressful once I got out of engineering and got into computer science. And then when I got a master's degree in database design, they sent me to the Defense Information Systems Agency, DISA, which was a joint command out of Washington, D.C. Main offices were down there near the Pentagon, but I was in Sterling, Virginia, and I was working on the Global Command and Control System. And I was responsible for worldwide distribution of software upgrades and installation of new systems, which at that time mostly meant Bosnia. So I was sending teams to Bosnia to set up global command and control sites. And that was really exciting. It was a lot of fun, but I didn't enjoy that tour because it wasn't Navy. I was working with Army, Air Force, Marines, and there were some Navy folks there, but it was not a Navy command. I worked for an Army officer, which was culture shock.
Was it culturally different because of the different branches of service?
Part of it was also that it was heavily civilian, and this was the first time I had worked at a place that had a lot of civilian employees. It was almost more civilian than military.
Mm.
So that was
mm-hmm.
not problematic, but it also wasn't comfortable. I mean, I was used to working with sailors and
mm-hmm.
fellow officers. So that was part of it. And then part of it was working for an Army officer. Was a very different leadership style than I had been accustomed to.
What was the leadership style and what had you been accustomed to?
This was more more directive, more micromanaging, more just...
Could it be a style versus the necessarily the branch of service?
It's been a pretty consistent style with other Army folks that I've worked for. So I tend to think it's cultural. So I worked for him for a while, and then he was replaced by an Air Force officer, which was a completely different culture, which I loved. Decided maybe I should have joined the Air Force because that was really fun. Definitely laid back, hands off. And again, that is something that I found to be consistent with other Air Force officers I've worked with.
So how would you identify the naval officer then?
Not as micromanaging, but very unforgiving. As a culture, I think that we give you a lot of authority, give you a lot of responsibility, and we hold you absolutely responsible for everything that happens, good or bad. If you do well, you are lauded, and if you do poorly, you are sacrificed. And I liked that, though, because I liked the freedom to do what I wanted to do, you know, and I didn't mind being responsible for the consequences if I had control over the process. So I think that was what I was comfortable with.
So then after this global command...
That's when I chose to take the early retirement.
Okay.
That's when Tara came out. At that time, my kids were little. They were nursery school and kindergarten, and it was... it was either accept commander and commit to another 5 years or leave as lieutenant commander and go home and retire. And I thought, it's time. You know, it wasn't fun anymore. There was no guarantee that I was going to go back to a Navy command. There was a good chance that I'd go back to another joint command. So I decided that I had enough fun, or as we say, my fun meter was pegged. So I put my papers in and took my babies, and we retired to Kentucky.
Wow. Okay. Tell me, which tour of duty was your favorite and why?
I think my division officer tour, when I was on the
first
Proteus,
assignment?
The subtender. I didn't have any commitments outside my job. I was... insanely enthusiastic. The captain used to just laugh at me. They had to force me to get an apartment off the ship because once they gave me my stateroom, I said, oh, great, I can work all the time. And I think I stood triple watches to qualify early. I just loved everything. And when I was in the repair office, I wanted to learn so badly that I would tell the guys that were going down to fix valves and pumps and things on the submarine to come and get me. And when the department head wasn't looking, I'd sneak out with them and I would go down into the bilges of the submarine and the guys would teach me, you know, what they were doing, and they would teach me how to catch them. They would say things like, you know, we're supposed to torque this to, you know, 110 PSI, but if you don't watch us, we're just going to give it a good yank. And, you know, you got to be careful because, you know, we'll take a shortcut here, we'll take a shortcut there. And, you know, they gave me the vocabulary I needed to be competent at my job. And it was just fun. You know, it was every day was something new and exciting. The first time I got underway was just thrilling. The first time I took the con and drove the ship was exciting. I remember when my first deployment, being out in the middle of the ocean and going out and looking at the sky and seeing the stars and seeing how incredible it was. And then when I got into port...
Where were you?
It was in the Indian Ocean. It was the Pacific Ocean. We were on our way to the Indian Ocean. And it was just breathtaking. And I remember calling my dad as soon as we got into port and just talking to him about it. And he said, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, and I think that's when I bonded with my father in a way that I never had. And that was also a time when, you know, I would talk to my father a lot and he would, you know, tell me things that he never told me, you know, when I was a kid. But now as a, you know, fellow officer, you know, we could talk about it and share experiences that he had never talked to me about. And it was fun, you know.
Okay. Which assignment was your most difficult and why?
think it was being chief engineer. It was just very hard. You know, it was hard work. I had a wonderfully supportive commanding officer who was just amazing. But the work was hard. The ship was falling apart. The three chief engineers prior to me had all been fired.
Now, this is in the San Diego.
This was the San Diego one. This is when I was on the Jason. Mm-hmm. You know, the three chief engineers prior to me had not been successful. The ship had not passed an engineering inspection in 10 years. It was a disaster.
How did you handle that?
I just came in and called everyone in and said, we need to change this. And I got hard. You know, I had to be really, really tough. And, you know, we're not leaving till things get fixed. And
Did you make a silk purse out of a sow's ear?
I did. We wound up winning the Engineering E.
Wow. And tell me how you did that. Tell me how you got there. How'd you get from point disaster to success?
The biggest problem with my predecessors had been paperwork. They didn't do the paperwork. And so I was meticulous. So I went through and you know, required just religious adherence to log keeping. And I was meticulous, you know. I worked 18, 20-hour days, and I looked at everything, and I asked questions about everything. And I was a stickler for maintenance, and I was, you know, a stickler for solid answers on repairs, you know.
Did you have to be tough on your crew?
Yes, very much
that
so.
Did you get some negative feedback because of that?
At first, they didn't like hearing no liberty from a woman, you know. I don't think they would have liked it much from a man, but they really didn't like it from me. The fact that I didn't have a propulsion background to rival my predecessors made me suspect in their eyes. But I won their trust and their confidence by taking care of them. I think it was, we were underway, and my guys, we had so few watchstanders that my troops had to spend 12 on, 12 off. I mean, they stood ridiculous. No, it was 6 on, 6 off, but 2 watches a day. So they would be on watch for 12 hours a day. So when they got off their 6-hour watch, they were hungry, especially when they stood 6 to 12. Mm-hmm. And I remember they were getting nothing decent to eat for mid-rats, the midnight rations. And so I went to the supply officer, and I went to the food service officer first and got blown off. And then I went to the supply officer. And when the next evening the food service officer was personally standing there grilling them steaks for dinner, and that went a long way towards me, you know, getting their trust. I empowered my senior enlisted folks to do what needed to be done. I asked more questions than I gave directions. And I think it was just asking the right questions and, you know, why can't we do this? Why is it that way?
Okay. Did you ever feel any danger at all during your service? Were you ever in a place where your safety was at issue?
No, I mean, I felt assaulted at department head school, but not, I didn't think I was ever going to suffer real bodily harm.
Okay. From a wartime perspective.
Actually, there were a few occasions where I remember we had flooding in one of the engineering spaces, and I ran down to see what was going on, and it was actually a fuel tank had lined up the fueling incorrectly, and fuel was overflowing into the electrical switchboard room. And the poor little switchboard operator was standing there frozen with fear as fuel oil is coming up around his ankles. And I ran down there and was standing there and just shouted to him to shut it down, because he was afraid to shut down power on the ship without mm-hmm. authorization. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was a little fear at that moment, because I didn't know what was going to happen when he threw those switches. And then there was another time where we had a fire, you know, and we got it under control pretty quickly. But, you know, there was that moment of, how bad is this going to be, you know?
Okay. Yes, I should have corrected myself mm-hmm. from an operational standpoint. Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel there was any danger? Mm-hmm. Okay. We talked about, my next question was, as a female service member, do you recall a time you experienced discrimination? I think you've laid that out that you did. What did you learn most from your time serving in the military?
I joined the service shy, quiet, kind of mealy-mouthed, definitely not one to speak up for myself. And I learned that you can teach yourself to be strong. When I was a division officer, I knew that I was not going to be good at telling people what to do. So I started small, and I used to pick on safety issues. And I would walk around looking for people who were violating safety, and I would stop and say, you need to protect your eyes, you need to get goggles, you need to do it now. Because I thought that was safe. You know, I'm looking out for them. It's for their own good. This is a safe way for me to exert authority. Mm-hmm. And so I would look for opportunities where I could get comfortable in exerting authority. Mm-hmm. And I worked at it. I worked very hard at how to be a strong leader.
Do you think you accomplished that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what advice would you give young women today who serve in the military or who are interested in serving in the military?
I would say be sure it's what you want before you join. Know what you're giving up. Because
what do you think you're giving up?
I personally have a lot of reservations about women who try to have children early in their career. And so I think that if you do that, you're making a mistake. I think you'll shortchange your career and your children. So you will give up being a young mother. If you do it right, you will wait until you are later in your career to have your children, which means you sacrifice being a 20-something mom. Mm-hmm.
And what age were you when you became a mother?
33 and
okay.
35.
Okay.
So not being a young mom, that's a big deal. And so if you have children on active duty, you know, you're going to sacrifice being a stay-at-home mom, too. You know, I had mine late in my career so that I would at least have some of their childhood when I could be with them. So know whether or not you want children, I think, is a big thing. And then if it's what you want to do, do it well, you know, and accept the fact that you have to be better than the guys. Even today, I don't think that a woman can go into the service and be successful if she's just good. She has to be better. That was the way it was when I was in now, and I honestly don't think it's changed. And I don't think it's ever going to change. But luckily, it's not hard. You know, it is not hard for us to be the best at what we do. And don't take no for an answer. You know, I didn't think that women were ever going to be allowed on combatants, but I didn't give up. You know, if we had not done our time on the tenders, if we hadn't, you know, been the non-combatants, mm-hmm. then there would not be women on combatants today. You know, sometimes you have to pay it forward.
So you paved a path.
Mm-hmm. I would have loved to be on a cruiser. I would have loved to have been on a destroyer. My dream was to be on a battleship. I would have given anything.
And why was it your dream to serve on a battleship?
Oh, because they're sexy. There's something about those ships that is just breathtaking. They will take your breath away.
The
design of the ship, the history
the
of the ship.
The purpose of the ship.
The mission,
yeah.
What they do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just more fun. It's just exciting. I remember the most disappointing time in my career was when I was waiting to find out where I was going to be chief engineer. There was a brand new class of ammunition ships that were gas turbine, and I wanted them so bad because it was not a combatant. I could technically have it. You know, it was on that sort of mm-hmm. is it or isn't it a combatant, but mm-hmm. there was a good shot that a woman could be given that billet, but it was gas turbine. So it was the first of the gas turbine auxiliaries, and what are we going to do with these? And I remember being in department head school in the wardroom, calling my detailer saying, I want this ship. And he said, oh, wow, no, that's too good. We'll never give that to a woman. And I literally ripped the phone off the wall and threw it across the room. I had never been so angry or so upset in my entire career.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got Jason and it worked out okay.
There you go.
You know.
I'm just curious. you majored in anthropology and psychology, mm-hmm. and yet you went into very technical fields in the Navy. How did you get that interest and that passion for these technical fields when your undergraduate degrees were, I'm sure there's some technical aspects mm-hmm. to them, but they're not no. just considered technically technical.
Well, fortunately, they didn't ask me what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. They said it was basically you get a ship or you don't get a ship. Mm-hmm. And then once you get to the ship, it's whatever billet is open. Mm-hmm. I actually thought I'd be an admin officer mm-hmm. or, you know, communications or mm-hmm. something like that. But that wasn't the jobs that were open. And so they sent me down to repair and then engineering. And that's when I discovered that I loved it. I didn't think I would like it. I didn't think I would be good at it. But I was. And then after I was...
What do you think made you good at that?
Because I didn't think I had to know everything to be good at it. I thought that the most important thing for me was to ask the right questions and just listen to what people told me and see if it made sense. Mm-hmm. You know, every time I've tried to learn a new job, I ask the same question of three different people, and I see if I get three different answers. And if I get the same answer from three different people, then I think it's right. And I did the same thing when I was on the ship. It's like, explain to me how that works, you know, and you ask a couple different people, and then you see if it makes sense.
So it's really about relationships.
It's all about relationships.
Yeah.
And I think it's communication. And women, I think, typically are better at communication. The male junior officers I know that went to sea, and especially the ones I taught at officer candidate school, they wanted to go in like a bull in a china shop, and I know what's going on, and I'm going to tell you. I never felt like I needed to be the expert. I would go in and say, I don't know anything, teach me. And they would teach me, and I was really good at learning.
Well, Commander, thank you for your time today. I greatly appreciate it. And how interesting it is to hear what you've had to say. Really, seriously, I've enjoyed it. Again, this is Margaret Plattner interviewing Lieutenant Commander Donna Scrivener, United States Navy, August the 24th, 2009. This concludes, before I conclude, let me ask you, is mm-hmm. there anything else that you would like to say or anything else about your career that we didn't touch upon that you think might be worth sharing?
I thought it was interesting when I was on active duty that the Navy didn't keep track of what the women were doing. We kept track of ourselves. Mm-hmm. The women that were qualifying for surface warfare, there was no list. There was no, you're number one, you're number two, you're the first to qualify, you're the second to qualify. Someone started a little newsletter when I was a division officer, and we kind of kept track of each other. But then there got to be so many of us that it got hard, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Anything else?
No.
Okay. All right. Again, this is Margaret Plattner concluding the oral history interview of Lieutenant Commander Donna Scrivener, United States Navy, August 24, 2009. Thank you.
Thank you.